Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the geopolitical influence of the Council on Foreign Relations on U.S. policy and the global neoliberal economic system. My guest, Professor Lawrence Shope, a historian who's been researching the background and agendas of the Council on Foreign Relations for 40 years. He has taught history, social science, and international relations at the University of Illinois and other institutions, including San Francisco State University. For five decades, Dr. Shope has been active in human rights struggles, protesting the Vietnam War, marching with Martin Luther King, and participating in the Union Movement. He holds degrees from California State University and a doctorate from Northwestern. He is also the author of five books, most recently Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations, and The Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. His website is Lawrence Shope, S-H-O-U-P.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be here.
I just want to see how current this issue is. So I watched five separate talk shows, popular on both liberal and conservative media. And without exception, each one had representatives as panelists or guests giving input, whether it was Al Jazeera, whether it was Fox News, or MSNBC, or PBS, or NPR. All of these people had something in common. They had affiliations with the Council on Foreign Relations or other think tanks, and as a result, we think that that is credible. If a person has a long pedigree, if they have affiliations with different institutions, including Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Columbia, Brown, we think, well, gee whiz, these people must be extraordinarily bright. They are probably in that rarefied air of very wise men and women. So what do I know compared to them? These are the same individuals who advocated that we needed to get rid of Saddam Hussein because he represented a threat to his people and to peace and democracy in Iraq. We needed to get rid of Gaddafi because he was a tyrant and was causing a destabilized Arab League and North African geopolitical strategy. We needed, and so it goes. And today it's Syria, or it's Ukraine. These people position the United States as the only beacon of freedom. In their mind, we represent democracy and freedom wherever we go. And therefore, it is completely natural and should be accepted that we have a footprint in more than 100 nations where we have active combat and military personnel. And we allow no nation to bring their troops to the United States. But we think it is necessary to be there. And as a result, these neoliberals, representing the full spectrum of both the left and the right at the corporate level, these people are never challenged on their sincerity, never challenged on their rightness. So even when they're wrong, as they were about Vietnam, as they were wrong when they caused regime change in over 67 separate countries in the last 100 years, when they were wrong about Iraq, they are still right about being the only sources that are ever quoted as a credible established authority. The New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, they all use just these people. You'll never see, ever, these institutions using people outside of that circle as your starting point for credibility and foundational truths. So there is only one truth. It's the Council on Foreign Relations truth. From that truth, all other truths are measured. So if you go against them, see how often you're ever invited in any discussion. I'd like for you to begin our program then by telling this audience, in whatever time it takes, the true history of the Council on Foreign Relations and the power they have with a geo political agenda on the world stage and some of the fundamental members of the global elite behind the organizations. The forum is yours.
Okay, thank you. Of course, this is a giant topic, and we couldn't cover it in an hour by any means, but I could certainly sketch out some of the most important features. The Council on Foreign Relations was founded in the First World War period. It came out of two sources. One was a businessman's organization that was trying to capitalize from the war by increasing U.S. trade and U.S. investment worldwide. It was called the Council on Foreign Relations. It only had about 80 people in it. It was an organization that was based in New York and had top lawyers, top businessmen, top bankers, finance capital as its main membership. The other part of it was Woodrow Wilson's war planning group, post-war planning group called the Inquiry, which was made up of intellectuals that Wilson brought together, people from the usual sources, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Johns Hopkins, etc., in order to plan out a post-war world to Wilson's liking. The first group was kind of floundering, and then the second group was also floundering after it was formed at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919. They met with the British delegation, and the British, what they called the Twin Institutes, the American Institute of Foreign Relations and the British Institute of Foreign Relations. The British Institute became Chatham House. The American one floundered and then met up with people from the Council on Foreign Relations, a small business-oriented group, and formed an organization whose purpose was to bring together men of action and men of intellect or men of vision or thought. And this was the key early founding of the Council on Foreign Relations, which has continued. They tried to bring together intellectuals as well as big business people and the wealthy. The American plutocracy was a key part of it from the beginning. The Morgan branch of the American capitalist class, J.P. Morgan and his empire, including a lot of his lawyers, became part of the early Council on Foreign Relations. They formed, and then they brought in the intellectuals that I mentioned, Harvard, Yale, etc. And they had a right away a magazine called Foreign Affairs, which the Washington Post has called the Bible of foreign policy thinking. It still exists today, of course. It's been going since 1922. So they began to plan for the U.S. to take over the British Empire. As the British Empire was failing, the United States would take over its role in running the world. And their first big study was a book on ore and industry in the Far East. So this is the orientation. You try to see what areas are good for American investment, and then you try to figure out ways to bring that investment in there, whether it takes war or not. Their ambition, extremely ambitious organization. I should back up and say it's a consensus-forming and training organization for the in and out people, the inner in people and out, as they call them. That is, people that come into the government from law or business or the intellectual areas and then go out afterwards. So you can think of all, you know, many of Obama's advisors, and this has been going on since the 1920s. So one of their big events or big successes was the World War II, when in 1939, when the war broke out in Europe, 12 days after the war broke out in Europe on September 12th, 1939, the Council on Foreign Relations people were meeting with the Undersecretary of State, a guy named Messerschmitt, and they were talking about the post-war world. So this is the ambition of the organization. The war breaks out in Europe. The United States is not going to be in the war for several years. And they say, oh, let's start planning for the post-war world afterwards. This is how ambitious they are. So they set up some study groups, and that's how the council operates. It operates, its think tank part operates through study groups. And they bring together a diverse group of people, and these people then study a problem, an issue, and then come up with conclusions. So an example might be in the 1950s, they brought in Henry Kissinger, a Harvard professor, to be the rapporteur, what they call the rapporteur, the person that takes notes and then writes up the thinking of the group. and Kissinger got his start in the Council on Foreign Relations in the mid-1950s as the rapporteur for a study group on nuclear weapons and foreign policy. He published a book on that topic and then went on to meet the Rockefellers and then became powerful. So this is, they train people to become powerful. Condoleezza Rice is another example of this phenomenon. So the World War II is a big success because the Council's plans were very important in setting up the current world order that we have, having IMF, a World Bank, a United Nations, and the Council was very successful in that. The Council had a big change in the 50s and 60s in the sense that the Morgan Group declined and the Rockefeller Group became more prominent in the Council on Foreign Relations. And I say group because the American economy, it does have interest groups that are very important in the American economy. There's, you know, individual corporations, but there's also interest groups. So the interest, Morgan interest group was dominant in this earlier period up to the 1950s, and then the Rockefeller group. And this was exemplified by David Rockefeller, who became a council member in 1941, a council director in 1949, and council chairman in 1970, and continued as council chairman all the way through 1985. When Peter Peterson took over as the council chairman. He's connected with Blackstone. First he was Lehman Brothers financier, and then he was Blackstone. So finance capital has been the dominant force within the council. It's a membership organization as well as a think tank. That's another thing that's unique about the Council on Foreign Relations. Usually you just have a think tank like the Brookings Institution or the Heritage Foundation or the Cato Institute, etc. Or you have an organization that members, like the NAACP, that's a membership organization. The council brings both together, which helps make it very unique in the sense that it has membership as a think tank. And it also has a place where you have meetings where they bring together world leaders. So its meetings program is also very important. And its publications, of course. They're not just, there isn't just Foreign Affairs that has publications. They also have a lot of books that they publish. They have blogs. They have a big website. They publish articles in other places, and they put out a lot of their think tank product, study group product. They put that out as well. So the council changed, and we could say that the council became a more diverse organization beginning in the 1970s, because before 1970, the Council on Foreign Relations was entirely male. There weren't any women in the organization. And they realized with the dissent against the Vietnam War, which the council had a lot to do with the Vietnam War in my earlier book, Imperial Brain Trust, there was reference made to that the fact that I've been studying the council a long time. I had an earlier book that came out in 1977 called Imperial Brain Trust. And in that, I go into how the council had everything to do with the background to getting into the Vietnam War. So there was a lot of dissent against that war, and there were some currents in American society that the council was fearful that they better become a more diverse organization. They were an older organization, a male-only organization, and an almost entirely white organization, European background organization. So they decided that they would diversify, so they began to bring in people of color and women, and they made a more diverse council beginning in 1970, a gradual process. It wasn't a quick change, but it was a gradual process. So the next thing we might want to mention is I covered from 1976 to 2014 in this book, and to show you the example of how the council has tremendous amount of power, I looked at all the top leadership in the administrations from Jimmy Carter's administration till Barack Obama's administration, and found that 80% of the top leaders in the country, you know, from president, vice president, secretary of state, secretary of defense, secretary of treasury, etc., and found that 80% were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so it shows you that this is the training ground and consensus-forming organization that brings together people from many walks of life, but especially big business, especially the main universities, the media, the top lawyers, and many nonprofits, all brought together people from, you know, foundations, et cetera, as well. are brought together in this organization. And Gary mentioned early in the show that there was that the people in the media that he was looking at, where a lot of them were from the Council on Foreign Relations, that doesn't even, oftentimes they don't even identify the people that they have on the air, like on PBS. They may say Washington Post or Harvard University or some other, some nonprofit, the Gates Foundation. But if you look at the Council on Foreign Relations membership list, and the Council on Foreign Relations has almost 5,000 members, if you look at the membership list, you find they're a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they've been trained and to think in certain terms, and these are the neoliberal geopolitical terms that they think in. So these are some of the key things about the Council on Foreign Relations. Did you have a specific question that I should, well, maybe I should mention that before, let me mention one more thing before we go into more specific questions, because I think it's important to know that the Council on Foreign Relations was behind the Iraq War. The 85%, I did a little decision-making study for the Iraq War, and 85% of the decision-makers for the Iraq War, including Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Don Rumsfeld, and Condoleezza Rice, all these people, members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Council on Foreign Relations had publications. In 2002, they published a book called Gathering Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. That was in 2002. They had they had articles in Foreign Affairs advocating for the war. They allowed one dissenting article. They did have a Princeton professor who didn't think it was a good idea, who's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they do have some diversity within the organization. It's a very large organization, 5,000 members, almost 5,000 members, plus they have 250 corporate members, many of whom are foreign corporate members. So they have a lot of diversity within the council as far as individuals, but of course most of them go along with this neoliberal geopolitics. There's only a few that don't, a few dissenters, and they allowed one to speak in the Foreign Affairs magazine, but overwhelmingly they were in favor of the war and they were pushing the war and made decisions on the war. And one other thing I haven't mentioned, which I should, I have a chapter on the council's foreign connections. And if you talk about the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, the Davos meetings, the Group of 30, all these organizations are heavily interlocked with the Council on Foreign Relations. And so they also have an international advisory board, which is made up of very wealthy people oftentimes, and some who were fascists. Like Giovanni Agnelli in Italy, he fought on the Russian front for the Germans, for Nazis, and he was for many years on the International Advisory Board of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they have some fascists connected abroad that have been a part of their International Advisory Board. So that's kind of a summary of this, a very powerful behind-the-scenes. It's part of the deep state, behind-the-scenes organization. And in my book, I talk about the council's grand strategy. I have some case studies. And then I talk about the ecological crisis as well.
Lawrence, I need now for us to go into different aspects of this. These are pieces of a puzzle put together because you're coming from scholarship that is verifiable by historical fact, not merely some personal subjective anecdote. Also, we don't want any of the information to go against that third rail of just being non-supported conspiracy theory. And I think that there are people who I will not mention by name who have gone beyond what they can prove, even if they're right. And here is my issue. This is the first issue. I want you to go through how they got us into Vietnam. Who were they and what was their goals? Into Iraq, you've mentioned some of the people. Why? Why did they need Iraq war and all the other major conflicts, including right now in Syria and the fiasco with the Ukraine and Russia, posturing in a way that would make it seem as if we are ready to take on China or Russia, and giving the American people the idea that we should. There are advocates all the time. Lindsey Graham is one. John McCain is another, who actually advocate for boots on the ground and let's go in and let's just take out Iran to support the only democracy in the Middle East, Israel. And if you hear that 1,000 times, if you hear it by everyone on different stations, and even if you hear support Israel, support Israel on MSNBC and NPR, and then you start hearing people talk about including on Pacifica and advocating one of their more popular hosts on Pacifica has advocated originally Libya and now Syria, but you don't ever see them apologizing, then first I want to know that all connect, because this is important, because then you have to ask, why shouldn't they be held accountable individually who supported this or collectively as a group for crimes against humanity? Then look at how beautifully they put this together. If they are in the White House as president, vice president, secretary of state, Justice Department, as attorney general, if they run all the different agencies of government, and no matter where you go, they're there. If they run all the banking institutions, the major banking institutions, and the media, all the major media today, at one time we had 1,200 media represented by 8 organizations. That's what we have today. Then no matter where you would go to find them guilty, even if it was not against a crime against humanity, but rather immoral activities, who's going to listen to you? They've covered every base. You're not going to get them indicted. You're not going to get them arrested. You're not going to get them embarrassed. And because they control every single lever of power in the world. Without question, they are the single most powerful group of people in the history of the world. And yet they're right there in plain view. They're not hiding. You could read what they're doing. And yet they covered their bases. You can't go to a media operation in the United States that's important, like CNN, which is Time Warner. Well, Time Warner's not going to let you say anything that's going to embarrass any of the people. So all the people, even if they have some disagreements on some insignificant points, you'll never hear them challenging the JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy assassinations. You'll never hear them disputing the so-called facts around 9/11. You'll never see them not supporting Monsanto and GMO foods. They will support the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They supported NAFTA and GATT, the World Trade Organization. They supported quantitative easing, giving all those trillions of dollars to the banking community. And so here's tiny little Iceland. Iceland with only 300,000-plus population, putting 24 bankers in jail for 72 years because they defrauded the public. They misled the public. They even did less harm than American bankers, and yet we didn't send one of our bankers at the Wall Street firms to jail, not one. Not one had to give back any of the ill-gotten gains, and yet in Iceland, they sent them to jail, took away everything that they made a profit from, and made them pay restitution. But there is a country who clearly is not important enough to have anything to do with the Council on Foreign Relations. But everywhere else in this world, you have their hand able to reach in and grab someone and say, don't even think about going there because we're already there. We control you. We own you. Your thoughts. Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, well, I think you're basically right, of course. And about my book and the question of conspiracy, this is verifiable. I have almost 800 footnotes, and you can go into the Council on Foreign Relations website, CFR.org, and get their publications and look at their annual report to get the list of their members and something about their organization in their annual report. And their publications tell you what they're thinking and talk about who's in the study group that published a particular report. Whatever it was on, whether it was on Iraq or whether it was on something about the environment or whatever. So it's this. My book is highly verifiable. And in terms of conspiracy, of course, first of all, there are conspiracies, you know, that people do things in secret all the time, whether it's a union organizer who doesn't want to get exposed and, you know, beat up by the thugs that some corporation will hire, or the union members don't want to let them, the bosses know that they're organizing because they're going to get fired otherwise. So conspiracies exist, but usually that conspiracy comes up because somebody doesn't want to hear what you're saying. So they want to figure out some way to smear it and say, well, this isn't valid. It must be a conspiracy. So this is not a, I'm not talking about a conspiracy. I'm talking about how, and what I call the capitalist class, and I have the definition, I've defined what the capitalist class is, people who have enough money to live on without working, to be very, brief about it. But if you have enough assets, you don't have to go into the labor market hat in hand to try to get a job. So the capitalist class is the one that runs the Council on Foreign Relations. If you look at the directors, you find out that it's the capitalist class in general. I mean, there are exceptions. The intellectual part of the council is the exception. They have intellectuals on the board of directors as well, but it's dominated by capitalist class. And this leads to an understanding of the foreign policy, the neoliberal geopolitics foreign policy of the council, because the capitalist class always wants to be able to expand. I mean, capitalism is about a system of expansion. It wants to expand or die. That's the nature of capitalism. So they want to accumulate more wealth for those who already are vastly wealthy, and they don't want to give that up. So you need to expand. Iraq, for example, oil was a big part of it. Of course, even Alan Greenspan, who was a director of the Council on Foreign Relations for many years, said that he regrets to state that it was all about oil, and people don't want to let people talk about, people don't want to let other people know that the Iraq War was all about oil and controlling the oil. So this is the nature of it. Syria, they wanted to overthrow the Bashar Assad regime and started help to. I mean, there was obviously a lot of dissent within Syria because of the fact that the small Shiite sect was running the country and the Sunnis were in the majority. So there was a lot of people who began to, in the context of the Middle East awakening there, they began to agitate, and so the CIA helped them get organized to fight against Assad, and of course we see the resulting disaster. So all these things that you mentioned, whether it's Iran, China, Russia, Syria, Iraq, Vietnam, it all has to do with the fact that these are systems that the United States, these are areas or countries that the United States does not have full access to. The Assad regime, the problem from the United States point of view, and Saddam Hussein for that matter too, it was a state-controlled situation. So the multinational corporations, U.S. and others, could not get in there to the extent that they wanted to. So what do? You have disaster capitalism, which Naomi Klein wrote a book about. You get into a situation where you break apart that government, either through violence or some other, coup d'etat or whatever, in order to open it up for foreign businesses to come in and dominate. And it's interesting, I studied a number of study groups in my first, from my first book, Imperial, on the Council of Imperial Brain Trust, which came out in 1977, and I've been following the Council, of course, ever since. But I did look at a number of study groups that the Council had on Vietnam, and they were talking about that Southeast Asia, including Vietnam, was a key area for the world economy because it was complementary to the United States and other Western countries in the sense that it produced raw materials of various kinds and agricultural products and needed industrial products. So it was a complementary area where trade would be back and forth very good. So they wanted to make sure that it didn't fall into the hands of the North Vietnamese communists and even overthrow the North Vietnamese if they could. Very ambitious organization. They want to, open up the world more and more to U.S. capital. And that's what neoliberalism is all about. It's making a world free of regulations and restrictions. And of course, with the Iraq War, if you look at my chapter on Iraq, L. Paul Bremer, who became the czar for the first year or so of U.S. occupation of Iraq, his orders that he put through were all about creating a utopia for these corporations. Low taxes, destroy the state corporations, take over the oil, etc. And so there's a lot of detail there about what their war aims were. And of course, you don't hear that term war aims being talked about on the mass media because they do exclude the other voices. How many times do we hear Noam Chomsky on any mass media? Almost zero. And he has a lot to say about all these issues. He's one of the, if not the top intellectual in the world, and yet he's not covered, he's not brought in for discussions on these issues because he's a very strong critic. And so he's not in the Council on Foreign Relations, so he hasn't been socialized and convinced that this neoliberal world, geopolitical world order is the right one. So anyway, I could go into more detail about, one thing I probably should mention because it's so important for people to know, I wrote an article, I should back up and say, the book was finished in March of this year, 2015, my book, Wall Street Think Tank. And that same month, when I had finished the book and had gone in and was starting to be put together, you know, as an actual book from the manuscript, a council came out with another study group on China. And the name of the study group, the title of it, was Rethinking U.S. Grand Strategy Towards China. And it was over 40 people on this study group that had been spending months and months and maybe even over a year. I'm not sure exactly how long they spent because it didn't mention it in the study group report. But they had spent a long time discussing what should be a new U.S. grand strategy. Up until that time, the grand strategy towards China was the strategy of integration. That is, try to bring China into the existing world order. And this study group concluded in March of this year that the United States should throw out that integration strategy and should start a strategy of confrontation. So I wrote an article that was published in Monthly Review in September of this year, Monthly Review Magazine, talking about this new grand strategy that the Council on Foreign Relations had formulated and disseminated into the government. And, of course, John Kerry is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Jacob Lew is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Ashton Carter, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, etc. Those people, of course, are going to be very attuned to what the Council on Foreign Relations is suggesting as far as a grand strategy towards China. And this is very dangerous because China is becoming more assertive. They're saying we should have more rights and influence along our own borders, such as the East and North and South China Seas. And what's more, we want to influence more and more Europe. We have a new Silk Road strategy. It's going to go through Central Asia to Europe. We're trying to get connections with stronger connections with the United Kingdom. And so China is becoming more assertive. And this policy that the Council on Foreign Relations is advocating for the U.S. government to follow is more assertive, more confrontational, and it could lead to a flashpoint of some kind. Clearly, they're influencing Japan. Part of this study group mentioned that the U.S. should encourage countries along China's periphery, such as Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, India, Australia, should all be reinforced even more than the ones I've mentioned, but they should all be reinforced. They should get their military stronger. They should come into closer alliance with the United States. And we see it in Japan with the Prime Minister Abe's new policy, getting rid of the old Japanese constitution, or at least getting rid of the part of it that was restricting Japanese troops abroad, has changed that and becoming more aggressive. So we see that the dangers here, Ukraine is another possible one. The United States, with the council leaders, pushing for NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe and then for overthrowing the Russian-backed government in Ukraine. The council has created a situation where there's more and more conflict. Russia feels like the United States is trying to get bases right on their border, overthrowing a balance of power there, and so they've been resistant to that. And I wouldn't say Putin is a great leader or anything, but it's understandable, and you should be more cautious about trying to get bases on Russia's border because this raises a lot of questions in Russians' mind. Obviously, Putin, but also the whole population, because they suffered so greatly in World War II with the Nazi attack. They lost around 20 million people, nothing like
Lawrence,
the United States lost.
Lawrence, I'd like for you to make your answers a little shorter, if you would, please, so we can hit on some more topics, all right?
Okay.
Okay. At this moment, the United States has been taking a more offensive and belligerent stance against both Russia and China. But first, Russia. What we're witnessing in the Middle East is that Russia has proactively taken the war on terrorism upon itself. Its actions and commitment are now revealing how dismal the strategies of the Bush and Obama administrations have been in the past. And right now, other Middle East nations are seeking cooperation with Russia. Iraq has already welcomed Russia military actions. Less than a week ago, Jordan agreed to coordinate activities with Russia against Syrian rebels and terrorist groups. An agreement was reached with Lebanon that Russia would supply it with weapons to protect itself from possible ISIS encroachment. And now even Afghanistan is seeking Russia's assistance. And yet, as you noted during our conversation, the Council on Foreign Relations was heavily focused on Cold War strategies to destabilize the Soviet Union, and members such as Henry Kissinger that you mentioned earlier, and Zinoviev Brzezinski, and John Brennan are staunchly anti-Russian. And back in 2009, the Council on Foreign Relations published papers from the Brookings Institute laying out scenarios of a Russia-Ukraine conflict that would involve Crimea and recommending the U.S. step in to manage a crisis if it were to occur. Well, that's exactly what happened. And a lot of us believe that it was purely 100% inspired, controlled, and manipulated by the State Department and the CIA. And clearly this is what has occurred, with the fascist government now being completely puppeteered by the U.S. and NATO. And NATO, in my opinion, is one of the worst criminal organizations in the world. It shouldn't exist. There's no need for it, unless you want to bomb another Libya, and then they're very good. So as the think tank for Wall Street elite and our hawkish politicians, can you shed any other light on, outside of what you mentioned earlier, that we want to have Russia be another market to sell product by corporations? Didn't we pretty much destroy the lives of the average Russian when we went through the shock doctrine there with Larry Summers and other so-called brilliant people, when suddenly they went from having free education, free medicine, free work, or at least guaranteed work, and to where everyone had to pay for everything on their own and everything was privatized, and that's how the oligarchs all became successful. Your thoughts?
Well, the Russia in the Middle East, I think first of all, we should say that understand that the United States was burned by its policy in Iraq. The Iraqi people rebelled against that policy. And so the United States had a lot of trouble winning the way it wanted to win in Iraq, that is, taking over the oil fields, and there was a lot of resistance to doing that, and also getting bases in Iraq. So they were a failure. That was largely a failure. They had some success, but it was overall, they didn't get what they wanted out of that. So then they felt they were burned, so there became a more cautious kind of policy as far as U.S. invasion goes. Although now we see, just in the last few days, Obama getting more aggressive in regards to Syria, again, creating a very dangerous situation. They felt like they had to pull back. And also, they're worried about the U.S. Public supporting some of this stuff. And so they're very nervous about that. So they're not sure what policies to follow right now in the Middle East. And Russia has taken advantage of that situation and had been able to get allies that the United States would normally be probably getting. And the Russia has been able to go in there and have some success so far. But the United States has been, and the Council on Foreign Relations is betting that there will be that Russia will get bogged down into a quagmire in Syria, and therefore it will be a disaster for them too. And that's what they're betting on. Although they're also having the U.S. hand in there just in case they want to intervene more forcefully, which they're starting to do in Iraq.
Quite frankly, Lawrence, I'm surprised by the lack of intellectual acumen by people who would offer that argument. First, you're not comparing apples to apples. Afghanistan was a sovereign nation. Russia invaded it and had no other support. And as a result, after some 13 years, they finally withdrew with a lot of losses, and also it really weakened Gorbachev and others at the time. Here we have a nation that is not being invaded by Russia, but was invited by the sovereign government to come in. Secondly, we helped sponsor the revolution inside of Syria. Syria was the breadbasket of the Middle East. Syria had a government that represented different groups. There was not ethnic cleansing in Syria at that time. The Alawite group was the minority, but it still was in power because of the Assad family coming from that. But there were multi-groups, including a large Christian groups that were effectively living in Syria. But then they had repeated droughts, and the wheat crops began to die. There was the Arab Spring, and into that legitimate protest in all the Arab countries where people were finding massive poverty and hunger, the CIA was able to infuse its agents and then agent provocateurs to go in there posing as students, as demonstrators, and causing a lot of the problems. It's now, it was Seymour Hersh and others who have showed the lies about a Syrian president using the sarin gas or other poisonous gases against his own citizen when it turns out that that was the Liberation Front. Then trying to state that the Free Syrian Army, which were supposedly only deserters from the Syrian army, in point of fact, they were made up of all forms of radical groups, including al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and early members of ISIS. These individuals were receiving funding, training in Turkey and Jordan from the CIA. They were getting arms from the United States, and one of the reasons that we will not have an honest question asked about Hillary Clinton inside any hearing is because both the Democrats and Republicans on the major committees, especially the intelligence oversight committees, that you have never, in fact, name me the last person in Congress who found information that was illegal and went public and said, I'm here to honor the Constitution and the American public, not to honor a secrecy agreement. Show me that person where they could say, yes, we have information that the American government has been engaged in illegal activities, and I'm sitting on a committee on intelligence, and I see the information, and it's not right.
Of course not.
You
they
have
want
none
to arrest
of that.
People like Snowden that have exposed that type of information.
And they never have to worry about arresting a legislator because the legislators realize that all those jobs that are going to come after their stint in Congress is going to come from one of those industries as a lobbyist, as a consultant, as an employee that that are all affiliated. So they keep their mouth shut and then later say, well, there were some things I knew, but I couldn't say because I was sworn, you know, to secrecy. Well,
yeah.
Weren't you sworn to oath the Constitution that supersedes that? In any case, what we have is we had weapons that were being shipped through the annex, not the embassy, the annex, out of Libya into three different ports in Syria, being used then by these terrorists against the Assad regime. Now, had that become public, then people are going to ask, what treaties did that violate? Is that not an act of war, which it is? And who was responsible, both in the administration, because that could only have come from the White House, and through the National Security Agency and the different departments like CIA? So then that would open up a whole can of worms, and then you would have had a major Frank Church investigation from the 1970s, and a lot of careers would have been challenged and ruined. So instead, they simply stay away from it and focus upon the less significant. Why didn't you have people there to rescue him sooner? How many cables did it take? They asked 600 times for help, and you didn't give it to them, intentionally not asking the important questions. So they know what they have been doing, why they're doing it, and they know that they're not going to have a media that's going to ask the tough questions, nor are they going to have Congress ask the tough questions, but they'll ask questions where they can posture and it's good for the photo ops.
And they aren't going to have the judges asking about war crimes, because people like Bush and Cheney, of course, were guilty of torture, even admitted torture and war crimes, and it's nothing's been done. verifying the Nazi principle, I was only following orders. They were giving the orders, actually.
That's correct. And also for the gas, if any of those rebels that John McCain's like to think are modern-day freedom fighters, no, these are terrorists. There is no such thing as a moderate terrorist. Is that one that shoots you in the back of the head but doesn't cut your head off? I'm confused about... See, I don't see how people with the intellectual acumen and the spiritual qualities of John McCain ever get elected to anything except maybe a warden of Sing Sing. That would be an appropriate alignment. So tell us.
He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as is Dianne Feinstein.
Well, now, here's the larger question I have. On the one hand, the Council on Foreign Relations know that you would never make money on a war with China or a war with Russia because it's nuclear. So they make their money off posturing for war, preparing for war, arming and getting new corporations to do new technologies, of which there are over 200,000 now, all making lots of money in perpetuity because they are on the inside and no one ever questions that appropriations to these companies because it's for defense. Now, take a look. Tell us what you see is the likely response that China and Russia could have towards this. China's sitting right now with $1.3 trillion of our T-bills. We have fiat currency. We are bankrupt. We are totally bankrupt. We think Greece is a basket case with about a 240-260% debt to gross domestic or asset to gross domestic product, debt, I should say, meaning they have 2.3 times more debt than they have income. We have between 400-700%, depending upon whose figures you're using. Corporate debt, $26 trillion, and household debts, $16 to $21 trillion. Unfunded pensions at the state level of over $5 trillion. You have federal debt at $19.3 trillion. You also have underfunded and unfunded entitlements. You start adding up all this debt, you're over $100 trillion against a $15 trillion gross domestic product, and that gross domestic product, trillions of that are from credit card purchases, which then shouldn't be used as a asset because it's really debt. And Wall Street makes up over 12% of that. So Wall Street is making money not by building new factories, not by giving living wages through companies that it finances, but rather making money off money, derivatives, credit default swaps, playing markets.
Yeah.
And
right,
so, therefore, it is not a part of that. And I believe that, A, let Wall Street fail. If you let every bank on Wall Street fail and every employee of every firm on Wall Street try to find an honest job, you would not cause the crash of the American economy. You would cause the crash of their economy because their economy on Wall Street does not fund the rest of America. They're leeches and parasites. And I'd like your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you started out by saying that the United States was with a war with Russia and China, that would be a total disaster, and they're, so I'm not going to go into it. But you should realize, and the audience should realize, that the United States is quite willing to attack smaller countries, smaller nations that they can conquer and thereby benefit, such as Iraq. So they are very aggressive as smaller nations. They do want to avoid large nuclear war, because obviously that would destroy their own interests. So China, getting back to China, China is a big problem for the United States because it's doing things, it's using its soft power by arranging for agreements with Britain, for example, undercutting the United States' longtime alliance with Britain. And Britain has been accused by many already of kowtowing to China because they want to get that investment so badly. And this is a big problem for the United States because China is using its soft power, and that's what the United States should have been using instead of its war powers for a long time. It should have been using its soft power instead of the other. Now, as far as your economic analysis, I think the United States definitely is a tremendously large debtor country now and is bankrupt. And the way we have to get back to something more sane would be a grassroots effort to have the rank and file begin to control these economic entities. That is, the associated assembled workers with worker control and cooperatives to produce the things we need, and that would also be very important for ending the problem of global warming, because having this neoliberal system where you produce things in China, what you even do sometimes is you send, for example, California, I live in California, send the peaches to China, have them canned there in China, and then send them back here to be sold. This is ridiculous. It's wasting tremendous amounts of fossil fuel. It's creating this climate problem. So the neoliberal world order has to be overthrown, and instead we have to have an eco-socialist type of world order. And how that would be defined would be up to the rank and file people, but the basic idea is you have to have a sustainable system that doesn't use massive amounts of fossil fuel. So we have to get into having public transportation be free and very efficient to get people out of their cars. We have to stop this neoliberal world order where you're shipping goods back and forth. You have to have much more sustainable production on a local level, and it should be run by and for the workers. That would be a real socialist society, is a society run of, by, and for the workers, the rank and file people. It isn't the state owning things, in my view. We can have a lot of different definitions of socialism, but mine would be the workers run, the society is of, by, and for the workers, and they're running the society. And that's the kind of socialist society we need, that would be ecologically sound. And if we don't have that, we're going to have a problem in terms of having, well, we already have the problem. You can see it already with climate change creating these droughts and floods.
Lawrence, let me quickly share some responses to that. First, it ain't ever going to happen. Never. Why? Because the people in power are not going to surrender anything, and they've already planned for how to control anyone who is an agitator or who represents a threat. And so those people would be dealt with very quickly. We have a national police state. We have a fascistic state. So they already know who are the union leaders, or who are the people, or who are the Chris Hedges, or who are the Cornel West, who are out there speaking, or the Henry Giroux, the people who are people of conscience. And so those people would be gone in about a heartbeat. Secondly, the people themselves. Now, you're assuming something, and this is just unnerving at one level. I take a look around me, and I see an awful lot of Americans who are selfish and dumb, who don't give a damn about anyone. But you gave them a chance to get something without working for it, they would take it in a heartbeat. You ask them to give something that would help other people, and they're going to look at you and say, why should I? We have had too many layers and generations of people feeling entitled to what they get and not caring about anyone else. Now, if this was the 1930s, if this was in the Depression era, if this was a time when there was low crime and people had to save because they had to be self-sufficient, where community was important, then I would agree with you. But today, you look, are you going to have the youth of today? The youth of today are the dumbest, selfish, most selfish, least empathetic group in history of America. They don't care about their own rights. Today, a study showed 51% don't believe that they don't believe in freedom of speech because they don't want you saying anything that would make them feel bad. They take no responsibility for their failures. They take no responsibility for the country. They're clueless about democracy. They're clueless about history, sociology. They don't know anything except what they read over their iPads, and that's only for a second and a half, and what they see on television. So they're disconnected to the larger common good. They're unaware. If you ask them about where the Declaration of Independence was signed, what year it was signed, and if you said, as recently was done on my radio show, the year and date that it was signed, and then ask them, what year was the Declaration of Independence signed? 80% couldn't tell you. I went up to Columbia University to ask students questions and was just overwhelmed by how disconnected they are with reality of the larger world they live in. So to assume that because we're going to get rid of the people who are in power, it's not going to happen. You're going to protest. Well, then tell me where all the protesters have been when we had 24 million Americans through 7 million home foreclosures joined together to stop home foreclosures. Didn't happen. When we have 18 million hungry children, and those children actually are not getting enough food, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics today, who's helping see that young babies and children have a home to sleep in, a shelter, or food? No one. All right? And when it comes to the encroachment of our rights, where they're reading your mail, they're reading, listening to your phone calls, they're capturing them, they're having psychologists analyze your porn selections to see what that tells about you and how you can be blackmailed, nobody cares. So on the one hand, we have a nation where people don't care and are not going to do anything, and yet they do care about Black Sunday or Black Friday. In fact, they spend $80 billion of money they didn't have for things they didn't need and trampled over some people and killed them without any conscious thought of that. So I'm confused about everyone saying, kumbaya, let's work together. Show me the people, because I'm an activist. I've been in the trenches my entire adult life, as long as you have. And I have yet to see, I've yet to see anything but dysfunction. You want to see dysfunction at the socialist level? Come to a BAI meeting. In fact, look at BAI. Look at Pacifica. They engage in censorship. So the poverty of mindset spreads censorship, because if they don't like what you have to say, you can't get on the air. And if you're not ideologically right to them, you don't get on the air. And yet those who are in their favor can privatize assets to their own personal need and exploit tens of millions of dollars. So I'm just removed from utopian thought, because I'm looking at a lot of dysfunction, selfishness, self-absorbed behavior. I don't see people willing to work. Maybe 5% of the people do, and those people are excluded from any power, and the other people don't want to hear what they have to say. Your final thoughts, please.
A minority always is who changes the world. It's not the majority, and you've described some aspects of the majority that are accurate. However, minorities changes things. And we see big demonstrations. For example, we saw in New York something like 400,000 or 500,000 people on the issue of the environment, of climate change. So we see big demonstrations sometimes. Around the world, you see the rise of the left in Britain. In Greece, there was some limitations, I think, to Syriza, but there's still some effort there to try to go against austerity. So there,
Lawrence,
I think there's
Lawrence,
always
I,
hope.
Okay, Lawrence, I was at the demonstration. Thousands of people in my audience were there. My audience is very progressive. Were you at the march with the environment?
We had one out here in Oakland.
Okay. If you walked up and down
here in
the,
Oakland.
If you walked up and down the pathway, you saw thousands of people marching for the environment, eating McDonald's, drinking colas, throwing garbage on the street. All right,
we didn't have that in Oakland, but
no,
you, New York. I wasn't
yeah,
there
we definitely had it in New York. So even within a movement where people show up, it doesn't mean they're showing up with a holistic mindset and embracing Gaia. But in any case, you've given us an awful lot to think about, and most importantly, you've finally given a name and an identity to the people who control the media. They control the body politic. They control so much. They control what we do. And now at least we understand what their agenda is, their motivation, and how we at least make a step, one single step towards freedom, is we get out of their world. If we stop reading The Nation magazine, and by the way, I think there are only 7 people left who read The Nation magazine, and 6 of them are in nursing homes where someone's reading it to them, all 2 pages of it, and then they can drool on it. And if you, it's true, and Mother Jones, you know, I thought they went out of business 38 years ago. Talk about being irrelevant. And last time I saw Pacifica had 17 listeners nationwide. So we have to stop watching their television, eating their genetically engineered food,
yes,
buying their clothes made in Bangladesh, keeping
yes,
our money in their banks, voting Democrat or Republican, and start looking to live an authentic life off the grid and join with that 5% of empowered people. And you were absolutely right. An empowered minority always is able to guide us through dark times, and that's how I see us getting out. And you
thank
have
you,
made
Peter,
a major contribution to this. Thank you very much, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Lawrence Shoup, Shoup, my guest, and his latest book is Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.